have the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Mr. Siebert, can you tell us what we're going to do today?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department is here for their Phase 2 hearing. They're going to initially respond to the prioritization subcommittee did a couple weeks ago and any questions from Phase 1. Talk a little bit about the performance measures and some discussions we've had with the department on their performance measures, and then get into the detail of the governor's recommended budget. And then later on, we'll provide an opportunity for some public testimony. I understand some folks may be time constrained, so hopefully we can move folks in and out as they need to make testimony on this budget.
Okay, that's fine. You want to take over? Are you leaving?
I'm here.
Sit in. We pass the gavel frequently in this committee.
All too frequently.
We just opened. He just gave us a rundown while we're on the ready to start. How did you come up?
Nikki, come forward, please.
Well, if you're going to pass the gavel frequently, maybe I'll just call everyone chair and then cover my
piece.
Fair enough.
Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I have some of my staff here and folks that I'd like to introduce to everyone, if we could do that, Mr.
Please.
Chair, before we get started. Well, first we have Lisa Pearson from DASBAM, that I think you've probably met once or twice.
Indeed.
And the young woman who just walked in the door is Mrs. Barbara Seymour. She's on our governing board and expressed an interest to be involved in the hearing today.
Good.
And I have Mr. Charles Kirby, who is our business manager and our chief financial officer. And when you get to the tough questions, I will be bringing him up to answer those for us. And next to him, I have Mr. Gary Lynch, who is the assistant director and runs our program two, the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. And Mr. Don Lewis, who is our assistant director for program one, which is the Geologic Survey and Services. And that's my group that's here today.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, continue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Mr. Siebert mentioned, what we would like to do before we get into the new information is do a couple of follow-ups from the first hearing where both we were talking about our prioritization, and since then there was a committee hearing where there was some reprioritization that was discussed. I had a couple of points I'd like to make about that.
Please do.
And then, as Mr. Siebert also said, we had a meeting with him on both our performance measures and our request for modification of performance measures, and we have a few points we'd like to bring before you about those. And Mr. Lewis will be giving that part of the presentation.
Okay. Very good.
First, on the reprioritization of the subcommittee, which occurred a couple of weeks ago, there were just a few things I wanted to bring to your attention on that. Now, I want to remind you that the initial request for prioritization that went out to all of the agencies had some general criteria that that LFO had given us, and it was based on those criteria that we set our prioritization for our agency. And so I'm certainly appreciative of the comments that were made by the subcommittee about their interest in both the livability, the safety, and the economic development issues, and the suggestions for the reprioritization. But I do respectfully suggest that had we had a chance to incorporate those specific criteria into our initial prioritization, we would have most certainly come up with some different listings than what we did. And The third thing I wanted to bring up is that during the reprioritization, I wanted to mention that we have two programs. We have our Program 1, which is our geologic survey and services, that the way it is represented in the budget requires us to drill down one level lower into what we call sections. And those are attempts at siloing some of the work that we do in the Program 1. However, in Program 2, we look at that as a whole program, and we do not separate it into sections. So during the reprioritization, sections were compared to programs, and we certainly had no intention of doing that. Very specifically on Program 1, we would have never thought of doing that because those sections are quite integrated. Even though we have what we call geohazards, and we have a mapping, and we have a PubEd, they don't operate independently at all. They operate as usually during one project as integrated across that project. One of the things that I might mention that as an example is we have conducted all hazard mapping in the Salem area, looking at such things as landslides and earthquake potential, in particular landslides. That had been conducted by our mapping section. However, that information is then integrated into our geohazard section when they're developing the mitigation techniques or strategies. And then that information is shared with our PubEd, and they're the folks that develop the final publications and the workshops and the seminars to get that information out to the land use planners or whomever are in customers. So it's not an easy, it's certainly not easy for us, and I suggest it's not very easy to always look at these sections as silos.
Okay.
Thank you. For our performance measures, I want to give you a couple of comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Lewis for a few moments to bring up some specific examples. Certainly, one of the large discussions that we had at the first hearing was that there is an interest to distill and simplify instead of broadcast across the performance measures, and we understand that, and we understand it is difficult to attempt to listen to all these performance measures that seem to be very detailed for many of the agencies. So we did meet with LFO, and we discussed a series of possible changes on the performance measures, and as I said, Mr. Lewis will update us on that. One thing that I just want to stress to you is in our strategic plan, we have three primary strategic goals, which are the geologic information that we collect and disseminate. It's our regulation, the operation of the regulation and reclamation programs, and the need for the public education and the what we call the outreach or the public outreach. What has been discussed with the changing of our performance measures would not allow us to be able to report to you on our very important mapping, on our all-hazard and all-resource mapping. And so we'd like to have an opportunity to spend about 5 minutes or so and give you a presentation on some of what our mapping accomplishes and how important it is to be able for us to be able to report back to you about the mapping.
And, Vicki, when would you like to do that, today?
I would like to, with your kind permission, to do that right now. It'll take about five minutes or so.
I think that'd be outstanding.
Thank
Let's
you.
Take the time and do that.
One thing I noticed everyone's flipping through, and I should have brought you. We will be beginning our presentation when we actually get into the budget presentation under the presentation tab. If you look, you find page 36. It's your first major tab in there. The performance measure information is actually...
It's under agency summary?
If you look... Excuse me. If you look under the presentation, you can get a nice summary of our performance measures if you look on page 31.
What presentation? We don't have...
This is for the performance measure.
And this is the governor's recommended budget book?
Oh, no, it's your...
It's the LFO book?
It's the LFO book.
Ah, okay. Okay, LFO book, members, under presentation.
Mm-hmm. Look on page 31. That will give you a summary of our...
Vicki, I hate to interrupt, but make sure that you're always talking to the microphone, otherwise we have some difficulty in recording. Thank you.
Page 31 will give you a summary of our performance measures and some of our modifications, and that would be a good jumping-off point for Mr. Lewis to talk about what some of the suggestions were. Now, certainly, through the safety and economic development performance measures 1 through 4 and performance measures 6 and I think it's 10 and 11 are the ones that were discussed in particular. So, Mr. Lewis. Right.
For the record, my name is Don Lewis. I'm the Assistant Director of Program 1 with the Department of Geology. Mr. Chair, representatives and senators, I'd like to brief you briefly on the meeting that I had with Mr. Siebert, and I was wondering at the outset if Mr. Siebert actually had some initial comments to summarize the meeting, or...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think so. I think that we had a good meeting just discussing really what some of the comments and questions that came up during subcommittee. During the co-chair review of the performance measures. And I might also just take the opportunity to let you know that when we get into phase two, especially, and then phase three, there's going to be lots of notebooks for you to deal with. So we'd ask that you bring your presentation notebook that you used in phase one to the meeting, because most agencies will be just picking up in that same notebook during phase two where they left off. Then you also have the budget notebook in front of you. If you're looking for some information on performance measures in the regular budget book, you can find that on page...
It's about halfway through agency summary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in the big GRB notebook, it's an agency summary, page 125.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have been bringing my other notebook with me, but in light of current events, I thought we were not going to have this meeting today, but we did. Can you, I guess as good a time as any, is our schedule subject to change after today?
I would assume that it is. However, I've certainly not been given any direction in that regard on the House side. So I think the question is still open. So we'll just have to play it by ear, I guess. However, I would feel fairly confident. I don't know about Senate side, but if the structure of our budget committees were to change, I think that probably on the House side we would continue with a similar format in terms of moving through performance measures and prioritization as we are doing now in phase two. So I would assume that would continue.
From the Senate side, is the discussion today at lunch was no change. We go forward as we've been going strongly. Okay. Do not want to change the format. We want to continue being a joint committee. And that goes for all the Ways and Means groups, and that we want to continue the joint process. We see no reason to change at this point.
All right. Well, until we get instructions otherwise, we'll continue on as we have, members. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And would entertain your thoughts beyond that in terms of performance measures now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would ask you, do you like giving this presentation twice in the next few days? my guess would be you don't, and my guess would be we don't want to hear it twice. And so, Mr. Chair, I want you to know that from our point of view, we think this is part of ongoing negotiations. We're very very comfortable working with the House Republicans, respect their wishes, and that I think that we're this close to, really, when you look at the percentage difference between us, one percentage point in the entire budget is over apart from each other. I'm hoping that can be resolved.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
I have no interest in breaking this process up.
Thank you. All right. Performance measures. Why don't we move forward?
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The discussion that Mr. Siebert and I had the other day could perhaps be summarized as a discussion of groups of measures that seemed to fall together by category, and they fell into public safety category that were identified, some categories related to the MLRR program that could be characterized as economic development and, of course, regulation, customer service performance measures, of which there were some specific ideas on how to combine and augment and accentuate those things moving forward. And then sort of the a grab bag of what's residual, and that would be the performance measures related to what we term as mapping performance measures. And in that discussion I had with Mr. Siebert, it became clear that we probably both learned as to how the understanding of what we do might need a few minutes to show how the various components that Ms. McConnell was describing fit together and begin with those maps. And so I've actually brought some prompts with me in terms of some posters, so I'm not sure where you'd like me to position those. But
Preferable if do you have a do we have an easel anywhere for them to set them up? We don't. Okay. Right in front of here would be fine, unless you need to refer to them.
I'll need to point out a couple of features.
Okay.
So perhaps should I, when I do that, and if I have to stand, should I hold the?
Can you have one of your staff hold them on the edge of the table there? And then you can direct us at that time.
It is easily one of his best jobs.
All right, this is a good place to start. This is actually a large-scale version of a diagram you have in your reports, your binders, on page 28 of the introductory notes, I believe it is. That's on that page. It's found in the upper left-hand corner, and this is a larger representation of it. And this is an awkwardly titled performance measure, and hopefully you'll be able to straighten out what it means so that you can see how it fits with the public safety as well as economic development issues.
Don. Now this is what you're sharing with us is mapping issues in terms of changing the performance measures. Those are applicable to which performance measures?
Well, I'm going to be describing basically the material, primarily performance measure 7, but also in performance measure 8 because it's linked to this material, and how they feed out into specifically performance measures 1 through 5, and hopefully I won't make that more confusing than that brief explanation.
All right. Thank you.
All right. What we have pictured here are, you can see, boxes of the state of Oregon, and some of them are infilled with color, the green color that you see, as well as some open ones. Those are an awkward term is quadrangle. It's just an identification of the grid system. This is a grid system that applies across the entire country. It's not unique to Oregon. And each one of those boxes is basically an area of about 6 miles by 10 miles. And so what we've identified there is around 190 of those boxes that in this case cover urban growth boundary areas and communities across Oregon that we focused on in this performance measure 7, to measure where we stand and where we'd like you to know where we are in our progress in terms of doing the geologic work that then leads to the public safety performance measures. And I have a couple examples of what those maps look like and a couple brief features of how they tie directly to the other performance measures. So with your some latitude, I'd like to attempt to do that. And I need to probably stand up.
And please do move the microphone over by you. And speak into the microphone. Don, thank you.
Perhaps the first thing I'd like to do is to sort of summarize a less awkward title for the map.
So it might be better, Don, if you just put it in the holder and set that on set the microphone on the edge of the desk there. That probably would be best.
You're very bold and touchy, unless you're going to do your Vegas app.
No, forget it. Of course, I'm standing in front of the diagram. What I've pasted up there in terms of a title, or if you want to consider a modified title, or perhaps just an explanation of what this is, instead of the long-winded, kind of jargon-filled description that we had,
Really, what this is depicting, Performance Measure 7, is the status of our progress of all natural hazards and all natural resource mapping. And these are fact maps. I'm going to be making an important distinction between what we call fact maps and what are analysis. A variety of the performance measures are related to analysis and the sort of derivative products that come out from that. But everything is driven by these fact maps. First of all, I'm going to show you a map in Coos County, in the Coos Bay area, the town of Charleston, and a geologic map here identified a couple of issues that are present on those maps and how it directly translates to coastal issues, tsunami issues, seismic issues, and why this information is necessary to depict. So this map is, in fact, that box that you see right there. See the same general shape. And even though there's a variety of colors on here and it can look very confusing, all of it is related to facts that are identified on the ground by our geologic teams, both historically and recently, and to characterize the natural geologic history of this location and a few key points. Now you can see the Pacific Ocean, the South Slough, and just in terms of getting your eye into it, I'm not going to be describing the rocks and the ages and all that stuff. Really just want to point out a couple key things in terms of the information that's on these maps and now in some occasions on digital maps, either on CD form or available through our website, in terms of the information that's characterized here. Basically, the information on here is we have a variety of sort of beach sediments of recent age and glacial times age that form terraces in and around the towns and around the shores. And then there's a variety of rock units that sort of wrapped around that are older and contain a variety of things. Each one of these units that's got a color here has been differentiated by geologists because of their different physical properties and chemical properties and what they contain in terms of and how they relate to mineral or natural resources, including water. On this map, there happens to be a couple other unique things to this map. There's a well drilled here in a few decades ago related to oil and gas exploration. There's ongoing exploration in this area for coal bed methane. They utilize our maps and what we've characterized here in terms of the nature of the rocks and where the coal is in the historic mining areas and where the methane might be to consider the development of that field and ultimately. Also, in terms of some of these grayish and brown colors, those are the very shallow and recent sediments related to beach processes, and they have physical properties that directly tie to tsunami issues and particularly to seismic issues. When the ground shakes, the sand material and gravel behaves very differently than competent rock, as you can imagine. It also matters whether it's man-made. There's a color here identifying just man-made fill into the bay, and that needs to be identified for engineering purposes. So just to step out from that on this is the same general area. You can see now a larger depiction of the ocean and Coos Bay itself. The area we're looking at is down here, and you can see this happens to be, just for the purposes of example, a tsunami hazard map. So it's showing the beach areas, the low-lying areas that are likely to get inundated by waves, if there is such a thing, and then inland, the particular areas where further analysis beyond where the rocks are, where the wave is likely to go in terms of where the greater hazard is versus lower hazard. Now, we can reproduce these things for tsunami hazard. We do this for earthquake hazard, which, of course, would be intimately related to the tsunami event. And, again, you're going to see patterns that evolve that match the underlying rock types. So really just wanted to show this example to illustrate that these geology maps, and I'll refer to my notes just so I don't omit something important, they're used for earthquake hazards, reducing loss from landslides, coastal erosion. In this case, we don't have volcanic hazard necessarily, but elsewhere in Oregon we do. Exploration and development for minerals, energy, and water resources. Siting of critical facilities. There is the potential for siting of energy facilities in and around the Coos Bay area. It's going to be very important that those firms on a site-specific basis consider the geologic information before they start designing and building and permitting and even the site selection itself, as well as other forms of land use evaluation or environmental protection issues. One other example I wanted to share with you that correlates rocks with how they respond during earthquakes. I'm going to have to move the location to the Portland General Metro area. I've got a map of the Lake Oswego area at the same scale of geology versus shaking issues. I'll take these down.
Yes, Representative Schaffer.
Is all this, thank you, is if I have a specific piece of property, can I type in the address and get all this information on the Internet?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, no. You're not going to be able to drill down to that type of site-specific information. Now, if we have mapped in your area, you can find the map said possibly the 1 to 24,000, what we call the quadrangle mapping, and you can certainly look on that and get a general idea of what the geology is in your area and if there's been a hazard map produced. But we do not... go to the point, what we call drill down, or we do not map down to site-specific. At some point, if you were wondering whether you had a specific hazard or you were looking at some development or building, you would probably want to go out and have a independent consulting geotech engineer have a look at your... And they would be using our basic information as a starting point.
Yes. Well, and then when... Will we someday be where I won't need that engineer to get this information? I'm just a common citizen.
Chair Krupp and Representative, I can honestly say that it would depend on what it is that you're asking. You know, what would be the problem that you wanted addressed on your individual property? We as the state agency, will never be mapping on a site-specific because that's... it's not only expensive, it's moving into the private industry, and we're looking at the larger, we build the backbone for the information that they would be developing on then.
Don, please continue.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Schaffler. One addition, I suppose, I'd volunteer is that as a public citizen and as a resident with a residence, on our maps you can find your street, and you can choose to look at where your house is located on there and see how it relates to the underlying geology, the bedrock, as well as any of these hazard issues. A lot of those buildings are depicted on these maps, and you know, it depends on when they were made. Again, this is a static product. When it was made, the information was put on. Okay. This is the Lake Oswego area. Lake Oswego itself located here. The Willamette River, Westland, Portland itself. Milwaukee over here. I'm going to be pointing out something in Selwood. Historic Selwood is located right in this location. Again, got a whole variety of colors. Each one of those things is depicting characteristics that rocks have in common for chemical and physical properties. And really just want to point out that this particular area, with the river flowing through it, has a variety of river-made deposits and flood deposits that from the post-glacial period that propagated throughout the region, so you can see shades of color here. And just want you to remember that there are shades of color, again, depicting various things. The key point I want to make is that one of those colors here, this sort of peach color, is depicting fine-grained material, sort of like sub-sand material, not quite mud, more like silt. And that's depicted in some of the peach colors. There's coarser-grained material, more like sand, almost gravel, that dominates in other units, and they're depicted in slightly different shades. And remembering that, now I'm going to show you a very gaudy image, which is one of our earthquake hazard maps. And these colors are picked for us, so we have very little say. This is on the same scale, but you can see again the lake, the river, Lake Oswego, Westland, Portland, and Selwood. on this diagram, maybe I'll hold it down here and speak to it if that's all right. On this diagram, you can see bright red colors. Basically, that means greater risk, and this is a summary of three different things. Those three different things are characterized over here. So if you want to see the individual layers, you can. But in general, you can see that the lower parts of West Lynn have a high risk, and that's primarily related to liquefaction as well as ground amplification, which means the ground, the soil is going to amplify the shaking more than bedrock does. The bedrock, the basalt ridges that you see in West Lynn tend to be are up here in the highlands. And again, they've got lower risk in terms of earthquake issues. And then in Selwood, you can see, again, bright red colors with this lobe, if you like, of a less of a hazard. And the reason for that, and you can see if you wanted to, you could actually go and compare these maps directly beside each other, and you'd see that this shape exactly imitates the rock unit as it's mapped on the ground. And so this product, and you can see there's other examples like that in terms of the exact shapes and locations of where things are. They're taken directly from the geology map, and then it's turned into, so the fact map goes to the analysis page. This is really spit out by a computer program, a federal computer program, that uses this information to produce this product. So this product, for example, is a performance measure. It is performance measure 1. Hazard maps and risk studies for earthquake and landslide hazards. So this would be the earthquake side of it. And Mr. Siebert pointed out a point that in terms of the percentages of completion, the target for 2007 is laid out to be 39%. The reason that it's that number and not 70 or 80 or some other percentage is that it is entirely driven by the location and completion of these geology maps. You actually cannot do this without this.
Hang on a second. Don, did I just hear you correctly to say that the target for 2007 was 39%?
For the revised performance measure number 1, which is, you may or may not be looking at the revised.
2025 is complete. Okay, so we have not seen the revised or the
I believe
revised.
If you look at Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look on page 31 of the presentation, the language under KPM number 1 specify earthquake and landslide hazard and expand stakeholder base. That's the language they want to change to. Again, this is one of those areas where they're taking old language, changing it around some, and if I remember correctly, parsing up what is a benchmark, in essence, into separate pieces like the earthquake component, that's what the language would be. But it's not reported in the annual report because it's not their current language.
So does the change in the current language then change you from the old performance measure, the target of 62% for 2007, down to 39%? What changes to see that much of a reduction?
Well, I can answer that. The current performance measure is a combination of a variety of these hazard studies for not just earthquakes, but also landslides, tsunamis, and what the communities have done to prepare themselves. So it's actually a combination of different things that, you know, what the numbers end up being what they are. We might be far ahead in terms of tsunami hazard maps, a lower percentage, as I indicated, for earthquake hazard maps. So the combination is what creates these different percentages in the performance measures.
Okay.
And
fair
just
explanation.
One last thing I'd like to point out in terms of, you know, well, that's nice, and that's analysis, and it's a map, and it's got bright colors on it, but in terms of practical terms, what does that do for you? On this map sheet, in fact, just off the map sheet, in West Lynn itself. A few years ago, West Lynn was looking at developing a new middle school. And so they happen to have a variety of properties scattered around in the West Lynn School District. And the planners and engineers have to remember that there are these products available for that area. And a quick reference check showed them that a couple of their properties were located in what are depicted here in bright red. Properties that happened to be down the low areas. They had underlying material that would behave very poorly in an earthquake, and therefore is going to take a considerable amount more engineering. and construction techniques to mitigate that and therefore drive their costs up. They chose a location that mimics exactly sort of the no color or yellow color that you see here. It ended up being the Rosemont Ridge Middle School that is located up on the hills with a great foundation underneath it in terms of the basalt rock and a gentle slope, or actually no slope where they built the school. And sort of an immediate practical decision based on this that turned into quite a financial savings, I'm sure, in terms of the construction of the building. And if there aren't any further questions that
members of this part of the discussion. Additional questions, Senator Bates?
Stay through the mapping discussion, Mr. Chairs.
If there are no further questions,
okay. I don't want to interrupt you. You're finished. You're through.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier in mapping about you also map water.
We map. Our charter or mission, if you like, isn't to map water itself. It's to map the geologic features that direct and control the movement of water in the subsurface. So, for example, on this map, we're back to Charleston. And this map, you can see a couple different brightly colored. We've got different rock units, and they're identified here on the side. I'm not going to go into it. Basically, on this map, you can see these are what are called cross sections. These are geologic cross sections that are cutting across the diagram. This A to A prime here cuts across here. B to B prime cuts across right there. So it's these two diagrams. You see they're quite similar because they're physically close to each other. As it turns out, the red and the blue units, you cannot get water out of. So they're very poor in terms of drilling a well into or sourcing water for whatever purpose that you have. And it's because of the physical characteristics of the rock. They're not shattered. They're not permeable. They're not porous. They don't have faults running through it. They break it up. And again, the faults and the relationship between these units are again depicted on these cross sections, so geologists and engineers and whoever can understand the relationships of where they should go to look for water, where to drill, where to develop. And as it turns out, these green units, which are the coal-bearing formations around Coos Bay, make good water and are a reasonable source of water resource. We've been doing these kinds of studies across the state recently. We've been doing a lot of this up in the northeast area, Umatilla, Pendleton, and have, again, characterized the rock units so that you know, if you know where you are underground, either in terms of a shallow well or a deep well, you can predict with certain accuracy what the amount of water that you'll be able to withdraw is from the underground.
Senator, are you satisfied?
Well, not completely, Mr. Chair. One of the issues we're going to be facing in the state is how we allocate the water that we have in the state, both surface and subsurface water. And there are discussions going on in this building about doing a very careful evaluation of what's available in the state, both, again, surface and subsurface water, and this seems to be, you have some of this information already. Have you talked to, have you been contacted about that survey being done, which is a little potentially different from this map? And one of the most important things we're trying to figure out right now is how much water we have, who gets it, what's happening to our water tables in eastern Oregon and other parts of the state. Some of them are dropping, some of them aren't. What's the science here?
Chair Krupp and Senator Bates and Chair and committee members, we're aware of the discussion on trying to assess the water resources, both surface and subsurface in the state, and we certainly talked to Water Resources Department. As a matter of fact, many of our maps are either contracted with them or we eventually supply that information to them for them to use in their modeling, in their actual hydrologic modeling for determining aquifer potential, recharge potential, etc. So we're not claiming that we usurp their information. We work on this to provide them with the information that they need so that they can do their basic aquifer modeling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just, again, worried about duplication of effort by various agencies and not talking well to each other. And that's not saying that you're not doing that. It just I didn't hear you bring up the discussion. I know it's a major issue we have in the state, and that we're going to spend a lot of money in the next few years trying to determine what our water resources are. And I'm just making sure that we all talk to each other.
Chair Krupp and Senator Bates and committee members, we certainly hope that we're part of this entire discussion, and we have always, when we develop our programs or projects that have to do with something like the water issue, that is in coordination not just with the state water resources, but also USGS and the federal water resources, too, are some of our either funding partners or our eventual customers.
Okay, very good. Thank you both. Appreciate your testimony. We're going to step back for a moment, if you would, Madam Director, and I'd like to allow some public testimony at this time, if you would, please. And the Chair would like to call Rich Angstrom forward. Welcome, Rich, and for the record.
My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I'd like to thank the chair for letting me slip in here. OCEPA's heading down to Medford here, and we're trying to put the final touches on our own budget for approval of our board that's getting together. So my staff's running around today at the last minute trying to make sure that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed before we head down to Medford here.
Get the priorities right.
In the right area of the country.
Well, Mr. Chair, are the concrete people going to separate off from the asphalt people and make two different budgets? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
that might be fun to watch, actually.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, you have touched on a very sensitive point. you have to be in the industry to understand that. I don't testify on a whole lot of budgets, and there's a reason for that, from my estimation. There are some agencies that do a really fine job of working with the industry and some that struggle and don't do as well. And the Program 2 MLR program is one of the agencies that I like to come in and often talk to you folks. I know Wayne's already, Representative Krieger's already fallen to sleep because he's heard my comments before. But this agency performs about 1,500 inspections with 5 or 6 FTE in the biennium. That is an amazing amount of work. They have a great reputation with the industry. Even when we're not right and they have to step in, they step in a manner that helps to educate the producer, help him get into compliance, and then as a last resort brings the enforcement tool out. And that's always appreciated when you're working with a regulated community that really isn't trying to do it wrong. Sometimes it's just taking that oversight and saying, hey, here's another way, and being educated and brought up to speed about some of the state-of-the-art ways of doing things. That program, the MLR program, just does an excellent job on that. The other thing that many of you are probably familiar with is the aggregate mediation process that's been going on that the governor put together based on last session's big row over aggregate and farmland. And the agency has been part of that particular mediation process with the governor providing data to Oregon State, which is, I think, helping bring the farm community and the aggregate community together. It's been, I won't say it's been easy. I don't even think I would say it's been pleasurable. I've had to sit on my hands often when I've been talking with the agricultural folks. But the data has been stark and surprising. In fact, during last session, many of you will remember I was saying that we probably consume about 10,000 acres of sand and gravel at the max, high-value sand and gravel, and some of the opposition was saying 70,000 acres. Well, after Oregon State did its study and they're putting the final touches to it, it looks like it's going to be about 2,500 acres. And when you compare that with a 17.2 million acre agricultural base, and you can whittle that down into many compartments that ag has, but certainly if you look at the entire agricultural base, it's a pretty tiny
and Rich,
amount.
That again is an OSU study that is showing on high-value farmland. Only
yeah,
about
on
2,500 acres,
and then if you make a straight comparison, we're a little bit confused at this point. The Department of Ag says they have about 4.5 million acres, somewhere in that range of high value soils in the state. Somehow this number of about 400,000 has been floating around, but still, when you look at 2.5 basically 2,500 acres, even with those numbers, you're looking at less than a percent, and you're looking at almost an infinitesimal amount. That's actually helping shape the debate. It's showing that the aggregate industry is not causing impacts, at least from our estimation, to the agricultural industry. And I think really the state agencies are starting to understand that, and even some of the opposition. I think we have a ways to go because, as you know, once in a political process, once you understand the facts, that's fine, and then you figure out what's the political palatable solution to bring everybody on board. So I don't know where it's going to go. But I will say the department, Gary Lynch in particular, has been there and has helped move that process forward in an appropriate and professional manner, and it's been appreciated by the industry. There is going to be a couple of things that you're going to be seeing coming over eventually. One of them is a fee bill, and I know it's kind of a bugaboo to talk about fees. Last session, OCAPA supported a fee bill with Ogami to add an FTE to their staff to help take some of the pressure off on the investigations and things that they do within the department. Well, the economy was still declining, and in fact, over a period of time, the state aggregate production dropped from 50 million tons to about 37 million tons. And since Dogami is a fee-based organization based on tonnage, they were not able to realize that position that we hoped to get last session. So there's going to be a fee bill coming over. I don't have a formal OCAPA position on this, and I actually will be lobbying the committee when it does come over. But for the most part, it appears the industry is supportive of this small amount. It's about 50, I think it raised about $50,000 to be able to pull in that additional FTE. But we still have, there's a couple outstanding issues that we're looking at. One of them is the director is going to provide our legislative committee a summary of the indirect costs. We're looking forward to that. There's been some issues in the past on how indirect costs have been divided up, and we're looking forward to resolving that issue with the department. The other thing that is happening on the substantive committee side, and I can't remember if Chair Krupp, are you on the substantive committee handling this?
Used to be.
One of the things that the substantive committee is looking at is right now they're on a sliding scale in their how they do the fees, and they basically block tonnage. So 10,000 to 100,000 tons is a block, and 100,000 to 200,000 is a block. And there is some discussion that may not be the most equitable, stable, or most easy way to forecast the Dogami budget from. And the agency is working with the industry right now looking at going back to a cents per ton. So everybody basically pays their fair share and doesn't get kind of lumped into these broader groups. I think that'll be good for the smaller producers, and it'll force there is a cap, and it'll force the larger producers to pay a little bit more. We will work that out within the industry, and when I come to you, it will speak as an industry voice on that issue. But if the industry can't complain too much because OCAPA's budget's based on cents per ton. So I don't think we'll get too much complaint if we move that way. But one of the things I think is important from LFO side of things is it is difficult to forecast this budget. In fact, the fee bill contemplates a static production. And we're estimating, we saw about an 8% bump in OCAPA's budget last time, and I'm forecasting now, in conversation with aggregate producers, a 5% increase. And one of the things we hope to do, and we'll bring this back to you next session, but I think it's notable to get you thinking about some of the issues that Dogami has, is coming up with a model that allows them to follow the economy a little bit better to project. What we need, what the industry really needs out of this agency, is a very stable and equitable feed. It's a feed-driven program, so we need it stable. We don't need it to be going up and down with the cycles. And on the years where it's up, what the industry is interested in is capturing some of that money and holding it so when the economic cycle dips that they have some money to flow from that so we basically level out the revenue stream, and we think that's important to the health of this particular program. With that, Paul, right? Paul and Susan Morgan and several state agencies got together Friday, and I will be submitting a budget note from that meeting at the request of Representative Morgan. And essentially what it is to kind of follow along with the mediation process and to look at consolidating some of the other activities that the other agencies have within Dogami, or for that matter maybe looking at moving the MLR program into another state agency where we can start consolidating all of the regulatory responsibilities under one roof. If you look at ag and forestry, they're relatively in basically kind of a silo, as the word was used. They're pretty the regulatory processes are pretty all much under one roof. In the aggregate industry, that's not the case. We're in DEQ and water resources and ODF&W and DSL and Dogami, and we're very spread out. And the industry's been interested in pulling that together to make a more effective process for the aggregate producers. And we were pleased that the co-chairs, this was a bipartisan issue. It came from both the Ds and the Rs for us to look at that. And Director McConnell Director Stephanie Halleck and myself and Gary Lynch were in the meeting and agreed to work on that and present that to you for insertion, hopefully, into the budget. With that, I just would like to say one last thing. This is how a state agency should work, and we're pleased to come in and talk to you about it.
Excellent. Thank you, Rich. Members, questions of Rich? You got off easy, my friend.
Thank you, Chair.
Have a good trip to Medford.
I will.
Is there any further public testimony here today? Why don't you come on up? For the record, state your name, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson, and I am here today representing the Confederated Tribe of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. Thank you for the opportunity to appear this afternoon and ask your support of the budget for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and their efforts to map the geology and geologic resources of the state, as well as to provide public education and outreach. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation's working relationship with Dogami is outstanding. Over the past 3 years, Dogami has been mapping the geology of the Umatilla Basin, including the reservation. They have been collecting pertinent data on the rock formations and geologic structures. The tribe will use this information to help guide the management and development of groundwater supplies in their water management regions of the reservation. Dogami has done an exceptional job of coordinating with the tribe at the onset of their mapping projects and of disseminating the data and information to the tribe and general public. We believe the work of Dogami in the Umatilla Basin is crucial to better understanding the water resources of the basin. The tribes have used the information Dogami has gathered to better understand the basalt aquifers on the reservation and in Umatilla Basin. The information gained through geologic mapping is fundamental to understanding current natural resource conditions and how to best plan for long-term sustainability. Dogami is proactive in seeking partnerships in the basins they work. They initiate and promote the sharing of data and information collected with partners in a basin. And their staff are quick to respond to public requests related to both ongoing studies and completing mapping projects long after the work is done. Dogami's ongoing consultation and expert advice helps agencies and resource managers make more informed decisions, and Dogami has a consistent record for collecting sound, unbiased scientific data. The long-term benefit of geologic mapping is shown by the ability of governmental agencies to plan and respond to resource and hazard issues like earthquakes, landslides, groundwater quality degradation, and groundwater supplies. The tribe is very interested in continuing geologic studies in the basin and urge the Natural Resource Subcommittee to fully support the budget for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and their geologic mapping efforts and public outreach. Thank you for the opportunity to offer the tribe support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kelsey. Appreciate your testimony. Members, questions? Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming. Is the ground level water on the reservation dropping?
I would have to find that out for you. I don't know that information. But Dogami can address that for you.
Would you like to come forward and have some come up?
And while Kelsey's up front, in case we have additional questions. Good question, Senator Bates. I think he deserves a thoughtful answer there.
For the record, I'm Vicki McConnell, the director for Dogami. And what is happening in the Umatilla Basin and the Pendleton and Mission area is that there are some ground level, there are some wells that do have some lowering of their resource. They're actually in the entire basin. There are critical groundwater areas where people are no longer allowed to even drill wells of any kind, domestic or irrigation. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla has been very proactive on trying to determine exactly what their aquifer potentials are to avoid the same situations happening to them. So at this point, we have not. They may have recorded some drawdown in some of the wells in the Mission area. However, that's just a small part of the of their property out there. But we do have a better understanding of why that is because of being able to identify some of the new fault structures through the mapping.
I think the answer was we don't know.
Chair Krupp and Senator Bates, it was a long-winded answer, and it has to, the bottom line is, yes, there are some areas in on the reservation that have experienced drawdown in their wells, but it's not nearly as critical as some of the other areas in the basin.
So, yes, sir.
Thank you. I don't want to take too much time here, but this is a critical problem for all of Oregon, I think a lot more than we realize. We always thought Oregon's got all the water in the world. Who cares? You know, how can we get rid of it? That's not the case anymore. And probably never was. I know that in eastern Oregon, some areas we have wells that are dropping. We're not sure why. In southern Oregon, we have the same problem.
Exactly.
And we're not quite sure why necessarily. We don't know if it's climatic change, if it's just more use of the water, if we're measuring better now. So I just wondered what was. It seemed like the reservation would be an area where they haven't had intensive farming at this point, and they probably haven't got large bore wells pulling water up for irrigation. The question in my mind was, there something else going on? You don't know yet, sounds like.
Chair Krupp and Senator Bates, actually, there is quite a bit of irrigation that occurs in a lot of the lands on the, and I'm not going to presume to know everything that happens, but I do know they do lease quite a bit of their land for both dry land and irrigated agriculture. So there, and they have, and then of course they have their domestic use, or the use of the that's particular to the Mission area. And I know that's an area they were concerned about drawdown, was in the Mission area, which is right next to Pendleton, and Pendleton has, and you know they're increasing their usage as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson,
the tribe is very progressive, and they really do a lot of good work out there. A couple of years ago, they made an agreement with the city of Pendleton to change the diversion point, and we had to go through state law, and that was a very crucial thing. But you know, I mean, I'm just wondering from the tribe's viewpoint, I don't recall they have a lot of sprinkler irrigation in that part of the country. Maybe it's on some of the lease lands. But I mean, is that something that's going to play a factor? And I know they have a big issue with their tribal water rights under a federal thing. I mean, do you know, Kelsey, whether or not the tribe is trying to put all those things together and try and work with us other fellows out there that are trying to somehow figure out the water, groundwater situation in all of Umatilla County?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I am not as knowledgeable about that information as somebody from the tribe. Unfortunately, they're not here today. But I would tell you that the tribe is very proactive in wanting to work with Dogami on all of these issues, and they are very complimentary to Dogami about how they are cooperating with them to work on their issues, and they're just wanting to find out as much as they can and be as proactive as they can.
Excellent. Members, further questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else here to testify publicly? All right. Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I might just draw your attention to some written testimony provided by Terry Gee that is at your places that will be entered into the record.
Outstanding. Okay, Director McConnell, please continue with your presentation today.
Chair Croft and committee members, I do know there is one other person that's planning to come in around 2:30. They could not make it before then for public testimony.
Okay. So. Well, we'll be happy to go back to public testimony when that time period.
Thank you, sir.
Looks like they're batting 1,000 so far.
Indeed.
Well, I want to take you now through the actual, we're finally going to get down to the meat of this here and talk a little bit about some of the budget numbers. And I would draw your attention, if you go to your
Which budget binder are we in now?
We are in the LFO presentation outline materials and supplemental information. I have a black one, but I think all of yours are blue. And if you would go to page 36, I'm going to take you through about 10 pages. I'm going to discuss just a little bit of what our budget strategies have been, some of our, you know, kind of the our budget environment and our challenges, explain just a little bit of how we operate both Program 1 and Program 2, go through our policy option packages very quickly on how they fared in the governor's budget, and discuss some of the legislation that is out there this time around that may have...
Where are you going to be beginning in the...
I'll begin on page 36 of the presentation. The folder 36. Says presentation. That's basically a PowerPoint-type presentation there. And if you just go to 36, says Department Agency Budget Actions and Strategies for 2003-05.
There we go. Page 36 of the LFO binder.
This is just to bring your attention to during the 0103 special session cuts, our budget cuts all became permanent. There was a considerable amount of fund shifting that we discussed in here from our general funds to other funds, federal funds, to be able to keep our staffing levels at where we determined is crucial to be able to perform our work. So we've done that. That's now permanent. We're also using more personal services contracts and temporaries to balance out our project work, of which we now have more of since we're on more other funds, federal fund. We did eliminate our editor's position. However, we didn't eliminate the need for an editor, so we've had to retool our internal staff to accommodate those required skills. We decreased our S&S expenditures basically through a directive to go digital with most of our publications. And that, of course, then cut down on publication and on our publication inventory and storage requirements. So we were able to make permanent cuts to S&S. For MLRR, we have been seeking outside contracts to shore up our negative ending balance and have captured the only county that's not under the state regulation for mine lands, and that's Columbia County. So we're contracting with them for their regulation, not their land use, but their regulation. We had some reduction in staff time, and we do have the fee restructure bill, the House Bill 2120 that Rich was discussing and that we'll describe a little bit more.
Now, Vicki, am I, again, to understand correctly, this is the 2001-2003 budget?
Those were the special cuts that became permanent in 2003-05, and I'm just giving you the background of where we're moving into 2005-07.
Are those, before I get Representative Schaffer, are those... were those special session reductions primarily?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Representative Winky, just for my own information, why is Columbia County excluded?
Well, they chose to operate their own program, and so they have a land use, I believe it's a land use commission that contracts out the operation, the permitting and operation for aggregate or for mine lands, and then that's tied into their commission.
Yes, sure.
Can any county do that?
Yes, no. Can any county? No. Could I bring Gary?
Mr. Chair, if yes. The director wants to just answer these questions for me another
sure.
time.
Sure. We can sit down and have a discussion about that.
I think at the staff has I think alerted me to a good point here. Why don't we have Lisa go through, before sure. going any further, Director McConnell, have Lisa go through the governor's recommended budget figures first, here. And I do appreciate the background from 0103, because that'll move us into 0305, and then currently where the governor's recommended budget. Lisa, for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Thurston with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll be working from this document here, which you should have in front of you. If you turn to page 2, you'll see a slide with two graphs. These show the all funds or total funds budget on the left-hand side for natural resources agencies, and then on the right-hand side, you'll see the general fund lottery funds share. And DOGAMI is an interesting agency because it's about 1% of both total funds and general fund lottery fund. Remarkable how that worked out. And just as a reminder, I've said this before, but in terms of the total statewide general fund, the general fund available in the governor's budget to the natural resources program area is only about 1.1% of the total statewide. Turning to page 3, the governor did develop a principal's budget this time, and the agency's budget is entirely within the principle that Oregon has a healthy balance between growth, infrastructure development, and environmental protection. The next 4 slides basically take different views of the governor's recommended budget. And on page 4, there's a slide or a graph showing that other funds comprise the largest share of the agency's budget, followed by general fund, but there really isn't that much difference between the two. And together, those equal about 75% of the total budget. There is a little bit of other funds non-limited, which I believe you'll be discussing later, and that is to contract for essential services to clean up lands following the default of a performance bond or alternative securities for mined land and deep oil, gas, and geothermal wells. The other funds come primarily from mine permit fees. That's the largest share, followed by contract projects, and the agency has discussed some of those with you as examples during previous segments of this meeting. That is followed by the nature of the Northwest sales, and finally gas and oil fees, and that basically summarizes where the other funds comes from. On page 5, this slide shows a view of the budget from the perspective of the two programs that it operates. The geologic survey is the primary portion of the budget at 77%. This is where the general fund resides. There is no general fund in the mine land reclamation program. And the other funds non-limited for the bonds is in the mine land reclamation program unit. Turning to page 6, there is another view of the budget. This agency only has personal services and services and supplies. Unlike a lot of other agencies that may have a special payment section, this agency relies mainly on its staff and supplies for its staff. And also because there is no special payment, that also means that there are no transfers or pass-throughs to other agencies. So it's a relatively clean, simple budget. Page 7 gives a chart of historical information as well as the governor's recommended budget column. As Vicki McConnell was just pointing out, there were reductions through the special sessions, and those did become permanent, so the agency has seen some decline in its ability to get its work done. In terms of the increase that you see between the 2003 legislatively approved budget and the governor's 2005-07 recommended budget, the change is really due to personal services. And there are two things, flex benefits or flexible benefits, which is your medical coverage, dental coverage, et cetera, have increased in terms of the cost. And then also the PERS rate has increased from the 2003-05 biennium budget level. Now, the rate that's reflected in these numbers is the one that we were using as of last fall. And then in February 2005, the PERS board met and set a different rate, which is lower than the rate that you would see here. And so eventually, your staff will be recommending adjustments to bring that level down, and there will be reductions as a result of that. So that's some good news.
Alisa, question for you in regards to the other funds non-limited. 0103, it was down to $3,000, and then 0305 was bumped to $100,000, and 0507 it's bumped it remains at $100,000. What is the other funds non-limited category? What is that comprised of?
Mr. Chair, it would be for the surety bonds, and I believe that there was some discussion just before the hearing started. The $3,000 was the actual draw, and the $100,000 was to cover any possibility if there should be a default. And it sounded like, based on the conversation, that since it has been very infrequent that that level of coverage is needed, that your staff will probably be bringing forward an adjustment to move all of that other funds non-limited into just regular other funds.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was actually just doing some research on this morning, and if you go back to, I believe, in even 91, 93 biennium, the $89,000 is the highest that it's been. We use non-limited for, you know, unpredictable kinds of expenditures that the agency would have a hard time dealing with through an emergency board action or some other kind of action. And you can see that the $100,001 is pretty small in comparison to the overall other funds limitation. And that, frankly, besides 9901. It's been around either 10,000, less than 10,000. I think at one point it went to 23,000. But I think LFO will be bringing a recommendation to the committee during work session that we establish some additional limitation for the budget up in the regular other funds and then eliminate this non-limited expenditure category for this agency as we've been instructed to kind of take a second hard look at non-limited and move them into limited where it makes sense and eliminate the non-limited nature.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Go back to the PERS questions. You indicated that there's going to actually be a reduction in the PERS costs. It's like every other agency, it seems like there's still an increase. Where am I going wrong? Is it $500,000 or is it $500,000? That's what I want to know.
Mr. Chair.
That's a great question, Senator.
Senator Nelson, I can't remember exactly the percentages, but in rough terms, PERS was 10.5% lap this current biennium. The governor's budget, it was 15.52. So,
yeah,
I was going to say 15.5%. And I think the PERS board changed it to about 14.5%. So you're looking at it like, I think it's 0.89 change of 1%. So there will be some change, and you'll be seeing all the budgets reflected that reduced PERS rate, and that's how LFO staff makes it look like we're doing something.
Oh. I like it.
Oh, the secrets come forward now. Now we know. Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Back to the other funds, non-limited. It was actually $3,000 up to $100,000. We're going to maintain that $100,000 and put it back into the other funds that aren't non-limited. Why would they need... Actually, it's a question for anybody. Why did you need $89,000 in 2001? And then you obviously didn't need $3,000 in 2001. What reason would you need that money for? It's a contingency fee for something. Why would you need it?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, committee members, we hold that money in the non-limited in case we have a default on a bond and that we have to go in and do a temporary fix. And in the case that means that's the money to get contractors in. Maybe there's something very important that has to be done before the winter season comes in, and we're not going to cause problems with that site. So that's why we have it there. Other options are, of course, to come to E-Board and ask for the money. But if it's time sensitive and E-Board isn't meeting in time, then that's why we've always kind of held it there as. And when you're looking at, for example, in the 0103 actuals, that's the actuals. We just spent $3,000 out of that. So we fortunately don't have these situations happen very often. It's just when they do, then you need to act immediately. And so that's why it was always been available.
I guess my question then is, 9901, you needed 89,000, and then you only needed 3,000 for 0103. Are you all comfortable, and will you have access to that money if we put it into other funds, housing funds, non-limited? Are you all comfortable with that?
Chair Krupp, Representative, we will certainly go. I think we can work fine with having a little bit of a bump in the limitation for other funds. That means we'll have something available there for that. And working with LFO and DASPAM on this, I think we can work through. And we may be coming back to you in 2 years and saying, we had a situation and we have to rethink this. But we're certainly willing to work through with this.
Very good. Yes, sir. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your general fund money, is any of that necessary to match with federal funds?
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, committee members, yes.
Could you detail for us the later time how that federal match occurs, what the percentages with programs it's in?
I would be happy to do so, and I plan to do that in some detail when we get back to my part of the presentation, if you would care.
Lisa,
please continue. Thank you for enduring our
question. I'm on page 8, and this page is devoted to major policy issues. The director has talked a little bit about the fact that as the budget has become tight for general fund, the agency, like many agencies, has moved to using more other funds and federal funds. And that means for this agency that it needs to go out and find more contract work, which is a significant source of their other funds. And it also means that they need to go out and look for federal funds contract work as well. You've heard also today that there has been a reduction in mining activity because of the economy, and that did create the situation this current biennium where there wasn't enough fee revenue to support the positions that are some of the positions that are in the Mine Land Reclamation Program Unit. So the positions had to be left vacant, and what the governor's recommended budget does is hope for the passage of House Bill 2120, which is designed to create enough revenue that those positions could be filled. There was a bond pool concept floating around. This is one of the issues with the mining industry, where apparently after the events of 9/11, it became more difficult to get the kinds of surety bonds that are necessary, and the rates became difficult for small miners to be able to handle. And so this concept was brought forward. In order to get it started, there would be a need for some capitalization. The agency came forward and asked for general fund, but given the current situation, the governor did not recommend that. But that issue is still out there. And, of course, the population of the state has increased over the past 15 years, and as that has happened, more people are living in areas that could be geologically hazardous. The governor's budget invests in earthquake response proposal. This would add a position to manage hazard mitigation efforts. And then, as was mentioned before, there were too little revenues in this current biennium to be able to fund all of the staff in mine land reclamation. And because of that, and because we require that agencies, one, come up with reasonable revenue estimates, and two, balance to those, agency had to take a reduction of a position in the mine land reclamation program. The governor then went ahead and said, okay, if House Bill 2120 passes, we should have enough revenue, so let's restore that position. But the difference between what currently exists in 2003-05 and what would exist under the governor's budget in 2005-07 is that that position would no longer be permanent. It would be a limited duration. And that would mean that at the end of the 2005-07 biennium, that position would automatically be dropped off the position information control system, and the agency would need to request it again for 2007-09. The reason we did that was because of the uncertainty around this whole fee revenue generation from mining. There was a change in 2003-05 that didn't pan out, and rather than go through another round of cuts and going back and forth with the agency, we figured it would be a good idea to make the position a little more contingent upon the fee revenue. There's also a reduction to just essentially general services and supplies, and that is about $40,000, and that is general fund, and it's based on the amount that the agency reverted for the 2001-03 biennium. And then turning to page 9, again, the fee issue, House Bill 2120, I believe the agency will get into substantially more detail, so I won't delay that. It is expected to raise about $49,758, which should be enough to buy back that portion of the position that couldn't be supported this biennium. And with that, there were technical adjustments. And with that, I have finished my presentation and would be happy to answer any questions.
Members? Good evening. Thank you, Lisa. Director McConnell, back to your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair Clark and committee members. So I direct you back where we had gone through page 36 in the LFO folder. And
Now, Vicki, I have a question about page 36. The page 36 deals with the first bullet point is 0103 special session cuts.
Yeah, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Chair.
Bullet point number 2 is not related to 0103 because it is the fee restructuring schedule, so forth. Correct?
You're referring to the balance fee-based program,
yes.
MLRR.
That is 0507, correct?
Actually, that's for 0305. We have presently moved into a contract with Columbia County. We have reduced staff time, and we do have the legislation out there that would have the fee restructure for the 0507.
Okay.
So this really is reflecting the kind of budget environment that we're in right now.
Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Maybe it's a question for both of you. I'm not sure. You've got on this, where is it, reduced, now I can't find where I'm here. Reduced mining activity, and then you have reductions due to the reduction in revenue from fees. And I think I asked a couple years ago about if we've seen a reduction in gravel mining, aggregate mining, due to the land use restrictions. And I remember the answer was no. But I guess my question is, if some land use restrictions were loosened and made more flexible, would you see an increase in mining? Because there may be some people that just throw their hands up and go away and not claim that it is they aren't mining because of restrictions. Would you see an increase in the mining, and would those revenues go up? So it's not exactly the same question I asked. And, you know, I believe it is partially, definitely, clearly attributable to the downturn in the economy. But if we did have more flexible, if we did allow some more flexibility, especially for local governments to make their own decisions on their own land, do you believe, in your opinion, I guess I'm asking you to speculate, would you see an increase in mining, aggregate mining, and production of aggregate, which we all need, and then in turn, obviously, if that were the case, the revenue from the existing fees would go up?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, and committee members, It is speculatory. There are a couple of issues there. Your land use, and certainly the restrictions or how land is used, may have some direct or indirect effect on development. Much of what you have for aggregate use, of course, is either in development or in infrastructure. So there could be, I mean, you could see a change there. We base more on, if the economy is up, people are building more, they need more of the basic building materials. So we really prefer to look more at the, you know, how's the economy doing and making our forecasts and assuming how we would
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I believe everything you said. I guess what I'm really getting at here is, and it's no secret where I am on this issue, in my opinion, the land use restrictions are driving these fees up. That's really what I think. It's making this commodity cost more money. It's forcing us to drive fees up so you folks can do your job. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at. So I'm sorry, but I had to throw that in there.
Glad that you did, Representative. That's fine. Further questions at this point?
One more comment.
Yes.
I will be supporting your fee bill to help you and the industry out, but that will be a rarity this session, too.
In regards to fee bills, did you not have a fee bill in 0305?
Chair Krupp, yes, we did have a fee bill that was passed in 0305. And again, it was a production fee bill. It was based on projected increases, or if you have increase in production, then we have increases in our fees. What we have found that it has happened is we're not seeing the kind of bump in production or the increase in production, and so our fees, our projections for our budget then, because they're based on that forecasting on the production, has not increased. Frankly, if we had not had the fee increase, we would be operating more in the red than we are now in some of this, because the bump that we did see, or the increase in the from the fee bill, allowed us to keep our operation at a level. But we did not see the increase to be able to keep the staff that we had projected that we needed.
So, Vicki, then how much money did the fee bill in 0305 raise for the agency for the biennium?
Chair Krupp, may I turn and ask my fiscal officer if he can give me?
Please. Why don't you just tell her or come forward?
Chair Krupp, we are looking at about a $100,000 increase for the biennium.
Okay, so if I'm reading the budget narrative here from LFO correctly on the back side of the second to last paragraph above governor's budget, it talks about the fee increase that was intended to enable, and I quote, the program to fill a vacant position. However, continued lower revenue due to fewer permits has caused the agency to keep the position vacant through the biennium. So we raised $100,000 for you in a fee increase, yet that wasn't enough to hire somebody for the position, and now you're asking us for another fee increase of $49,000, and that is enough to hire someone? Help me understand those numbers.
Chair Krupp, the $100,000 was not enough to bring to fill that position. We have been operating since the 01 session, trying to keep our fees up with what the cost is for the pre-existing for the staff that we have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
yes.
Maybe I can take a stab at explaining this. They had a fee increase. With an estimated revenue level that was higher than what turned out to occur. I think that what happened was, even though the fee increase raised $100,000, it didn't offset the reduction in what they had presumed would be their revenue enough to fill that position. So they thought the revenue would be, you know, at X. Let's just want to guess a number. But X, and it was actually Y, because of the number of permits just were much smaller. So even though the fee increase raised up Y a little bit, what it would have been, it wasn't enough to fill the position.
Chair Krupp and Mr. Siebert, yeah, it's not in the permits, but actually in the production.
Okay,
so then that leads me to the next question, inevitably, is, so you raised $100,000. It was to hire someone. You didn't hire the person, so what did you spend $100,000 on?
Chair Krupp, we spent that money to keep the pre-existing staff we have. We did not spend it on anything above and beyond that. We even, and as I was saying, the
the amount that it takes to right now, the largest expenditure we have is in the staff. The increases for benefits, what we call the OPE or the benefits, each year that goes up a little bit more than what our production was keeping, what we were being able to capture in our production fees. So even though staff is flat, that we were starting to operate in the red for the MLRR program.
So this $100,000 was dedicated to MLRR, correct? Or was it agency wide?
No, that is fees, and that stays in program too.
Okay, MLRR has how many people associated with it?
If you look on page, I beg your pardon, Gary Lynch would like to have permission to
please.
Come to the...
I would love to have Gary come and help me understand what's going on.
I would ask you, though, to look on page...
page
37, 38, so that you have the schematic for the agency. And if you look at the right-hand side, Program 2, the Mineral Land Regulation Reclamation, so we have the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, one open position, and then one manager.
Okay, I just did some quick math here. If you have 9 positions, including Gary as manager, and assuming the one position was vacant, which it was, and you spent $100,000 on that, that's an $11,111 expenditure over the biennium additionally for each employee. Is that what you're asking me to? Okay, Gary, for the record,
I'm Gary Lynch, an assistant director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And it's a good question, and I think the part that may help here, we went in for the fee increase last session, knowing that in the past and since I've been here, the industry never paid the total cost of the program. And the way we made up the difference to balance the checkbook was to competitively seek grants and other funding, which we had been successful for in the past. When we came in last time for the fee increase, we based it on production. Ultimately, it was never realized. In other words, in fact, it continued to go down because we have a delay or a lag factor of a year. So we ran into this problem. We weren't able to balance the checkbook. We did get a balance of approximately $100,000, but the gap that we started with only got narrowed to a point because we didn't get a former grant that we had with the Forest Service for $50,000. And so we started out behind the eight ball. Production was based on, and whatever it was, say, and I don't know the exact number, but say 45 or 46 million tons. We only got 37, 38 million tons. And so we started with the gap between what we had and what we needed. We narrowed it a little, but not enough that we could fully fund the program. And that's where this has always come from. As we started out, we were already behind the eight ball. So we made a little bit of progress on that, and we still aren't there. And you may remember, I don't know, some of you may have been on Ways and Means last session, but we talked about this, and we tried to build this into the legislation last time, which was to have an increase that started to continue to narrow that gap. Well, and industries, and their answer was fine, was that they would rather address it again this time. And I think we've had a better chance to look up the crystal ball of what production is going to be. We do see it going up. So, in other words, we still have that gap out there. We think now with this fee increase, we can narrow that gap. But caution everybody, it is a bit of a crystal ball here, and we don't quite have the same ability to recover that, for instance, Rich Angstrom was talking about, in that we aren't pennies per ton. We have increments of 100,000 tons. So, for example, we may increase production by 10% this time. That's possible. However, if you produced 120,000 tons last time and you go up 10%, it won't necessarily correlate into an exact one-for-one fee increase.
All right. Here's the problem I'm having with this entire scenario. You come to us last session. We enact on your behalf $100,000, actually more than that, was what was predicted to be, correct?
Well, we were hoping it would be.
Okay. To hire someone. You don't hire that person. So that means the reason you hired the person, I guess, is no longer valid. The reason you wanted to hire the person. Okay? You wanted to hire somebody, so you come to us for a fee increase. You don't get enough money, so you can't hire the person. So you use that money to backfill employee costs. Okay? And 37 employees divided into 100,000 is $2,700 per employee. No?
Chair Krupp, that's only within the MLR program. It's only within the 9 FTEs, theoretically, or 9.5 FTEs that are in the MLR program.
Okay, so it's back to the $11,000 per employee is what we're looking at. Here's the problem I'm having, mm-hmm. Okay, is that you didn't hire someone. You came to legislature. Legislature granted you a fee increase, and industry supported it to do something the industry felt was beneficial. Mm-hmm. Okay. You didn't hire that person, so the work didn't get done. We backfilled employee costs. Now you're coming to us for an additional fee increase so that you can hire the person. Okay? So how are you going to pay for your additional employee costs this time? If you're actually going to go out and hire that person, the $100,000 you spent last time on employee costs for 9 people, I'm not understanding this process here. I'm having some difficulty with this.
Go ahead.
Chair Krupp, again, if I could ask you to look at page 42 in your book quickly. I just want to point a couple of things out and committee members. Page 42 shows the program 2 revenues versus expenditures, 1993 through 2005, and in the biennias. And they're not, it was in color, but it isn't on here. So you have revenues on the left and you have expenditures on the right, which would have been the black and the red. And I draw your attention to from 1999 was the last biennia that we saw a revenue higher than our expenditure. So in 2001, as we went into that, when we were asking for the fee increase, we had expenditures higher than revenue for Program 2, 2003 the same, and 2005. So as Mr. Lynch was saying, we're because the production, part of that is that we think that production was down based on the recession that the state was in, and because we're all of our revenue for the fee for the fee based MLRR is based on production, it has quite a cycle to it. We're trying to keep a steady staff in there at the same time. That's where the difficulty is running.
Well, Director McConnell, I don't disagree with any of that. I'm just saying you came to us and asked us to approve a fee increase, and you never did what you said you were going to do. Now you're asking us for more money. Why should we give it to you?
I agree that we were unable to, Chair Krupp, we were unable to do that based, again, on our crystal ball of thinking our production would be high enough that we could justify filling that position. And we certainly were not going to fill the position until we have the revenue to be able to operate in the black.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes.
Sure. And it's the production that I want to speak to. We're barging gravel in from the state of Washington. You know what? We can be doing it right here in Oregon. Their production goes up, negates their need for a fee increase because they'll have enough revenue. I'm just hoping, theoretically, speculatively, so they can do the job they do. It is ridiculous that this state imports a thimble of an otherwise cheap commodity. And a commodity that each and every one of us, whether you're Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, urban, rural, black, white, gay, straight, man, woman, doesn't matter. We all use it. And, you know, this just drives me crazy. And these policies are driving these fees up. And then these folks got to come here and explain this incredible math to us all when the answer is right under our, literally under our feet.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr.
Chair,
yes, please. I wouldn't characterize it as the work didn't get done. I think what we do see, and we have the customer survey, I think, that indicates that our service didn't drop off.
Why do you need the position then, Gary?
Because what's going to happen is it will start to drop off.
Well, wait a second. If it didn't last time, how come it isn't now?
Because we picked up more workload in the interim. We picked up Columbia County for the first time ever. We have also, and the other thing is, I'm not here, you did hear from Rich Angstrom, who thought it, you know, understandably, that they understand that a field presence that's out there working with operators, that one, explaining what our expectations are, and two, letting us understand what their needs are, is an effective regulatory program. It's only to the credit of my staff that work got done. It wasn't me that did it. And they work weekends. They work long time. You don't see the overtime in there because we can't pay them that. Now, that sounds like a lot of money to me, too. But I may have fallen off the turnip truck, but it wasn't last night. Those people work hard, and 1,500 inspections, and it was really 4.5 FTE. And frankly, we need a break because I can't continue to ask those people, and I know this may be sensitive in this room, they work hard right now, and we need that help. And industry understands we need that help. The other thing we picked up is an issue for Oregon that's real, and that is we had significant amounts of mining before there was any regulation of that mining. And we have problems statewide that we're trying to address. We're addressing those in a non-regulatory way, but the rehabilitation of these abandoned sites is a real issue, and we're seeing it. We saw an exceptional program that went on down at the Rogue that we led. Unfortunately, that was a bit of a lost leader program. We wanted to prove to people we could do it, but we did fall behind in the checkbook, and that's what you see. And we did have somebody back off to go down to 60%, another person went 25%. That probably doesn't get you exactly where you need, Representative Krupp, but what I am saying is you're not hearing any complaints from the regulated community, and we're not hearing any significant complaints from the citizens, but the only complaints I hear, and there should be more, is from my staff saying, "Why, you know, how can we keep going?" And they're doing the. I've always said I had the easiest job in state government. I just report what they do.
Sure.
Yes, Senator.
A couple questions, if I could.
Please.
My sense of all this is that you've been slowly falling behind for the last 3 to 4 years, and if you hadn't got a rate increase, you would have had to lay some people off. That's the way you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just so I understand that. I have a little different question for you. This, your agency, what you're doing here is it's very similarly done for nurses and doctors and any other agency we can think of that regulates what goes on in the state. It's a balance between keeping your people you work with, I'll say happy, in my case it's physicians, also at the same time making sure that the public who you also work for is happy. I haven't heard a lot of environmental concerns at this time about aggregate, which I assume is most of this. I have heard some things about mining. Is most of your revenue and most most of your work done in aggregate business? Is that where most of your efforts have to be put into?
Yeah, Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, the vast majority of the mining activity in this state is aggregate. There's also a significant amount of industrial minerals and a little bit of placer mining. The waste streams that we see in terms of the environmental impacts from mining don't occur with aggregate like they do in, say, the precious metal sector or the base metal sector. What you do have is significant issues on the floodplain and that regard turbidity and how that's managed. So you're right in that the environmental impacts from aggregate mining aren't in the same order of magnitude as they are from metal mining, and we went through that in 91-93, but they still exist, and it's the lack of complaints I wouldn't take as a negative. It's a positive that we're out there, and I've always said we've had one contested case hearing in the 18 years I've been here, and I think it's because we solved the problems in the field and not the courtroom.
Don't take it what I'm wrong. I said the lack of complaints on the environmental issues and from the public on aggregate mining in this particular state, from my experience, is very low. And I spend a lot of time out there. I used to spend a lot of time out there fishing. So I've been in states where it is a major problem. Okay, so you're covering the entire state with 9 or 10 employees.
Actually, 4.5. Excuse me, Representative Krupp, Senator Bates, 4.5 field people currently.
Where are the other 9? You have nine, but you have...
I'm one of them. Yeah. And then we have an administrative assistant and a clerical person, and then we have a half a person that we have allowed to hire because in 98, believing in streamlining government, we took over the stormwater program at the aggregate sites from DEQ. We took 75% of the revenues for the program to implement 100% of the mining activity. So we've been scrambling forever, and frankly, that's where we get into trouble. By scrambling, we're always right on that margin. There is unquestionably a direct correlation between the amount of rock that's needed, the amount of population, and the state of the economy. So things are looking good in that direction. But I'd love to sit here and say everything's perfect, but my crystal ball isn't that good.
Well, Mr. Chair, so you're in cyclic business, what you're telling me here, and I understand that.
You say psychic?
That's the business I'm in, psycho. You know? And so you're in a cyclic business to a great degree, although obviously you know that already. You're getting, if I remember, numbers are correct, you get about $1.5 million roughly in fees every year, and the rest of it's other funds and federal funds. But the other funds I'm talking about is the 1.5 in fees. Do you have any idea what the aggregate business as a book of business is worth? What's the number on that?
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, it's about $250 million industry at the mine mouth. So in other words, the product at the point it goes onto the county road is about $250 million.
Total for the state?
Total for the state with a multiplier conservatively estimated at 2.
And you're collecting 1.5 against that 250 million as far as inspections are concerned. And you want to go up 40,000.
We estimate, between 40 to 70. Tell me what production is going to be, and I'll give you a little better answer.
But the point I'm driving to is, and it's, I hope you're going in the same direction. I can't if you're not. We have cyclic businesses also and other agencies like this, and they have to look forward enough and have a funding source forward enough that they don't run in the red. And you can't afford to do that. I don't know who's funding the difference for you here, but somebody is. And I would frankly tell you, even going up 40,000, you know, you may still be in the red here in a couple of years and come back and talk to us again. I don't think you get a fix here. Mr. Chair, what I would suggest we do, if we could, and not spend the rest of the little time we have here on this, is I would like to see a rundown of what your expenses are for the last 2 or 3 years, where you expect them to go for the next 4 years, the next 2 bienniums, and come in with a fee schedule that makes that work, and outline for us carefully what those people do. And you got 4 or 5 people who build, 2 or 3 in the home offices. This is micromanaging a budget. I mean, it's nothing personal, but we've got a lot bigger budgets to sweat over. But you guys can't be. We don't want you setting an example for the rest of the state running in the red. Nothing personal.
No, none taken.
And I agree with the chair's concerns here. So I would like to see some hard data. I mean, looking at this and listening to the conversation, I can't tell what you're doing. I can't tell. But I'm worried you're going to be back here in 2 years, same discussion.
Chair Krupp, Senator Bates, I mean, and that's what we've proposed, the pennies per ton. We think that would be fair. In addition, by the way, we've proposed the fee decrease this time for the smaller operators to address the issue that the large companies don't go to rural Oregon and yet rock's still needed. And the other thing I'd mention on the record here is that even though production is down, our number of permits doesn't decrease dramatically, so the workload stays about the same. If in some degree it goes up because the economics of the industry become more marginal, maybe somebody's going to take an extra chance they wouldn't otherwise take. So we're dealing with that issue. And that is, I mean, everybody goes through those same things, and we understand, you know, where we sit in this picture. But, you know, again, you heard Rich say this morning that they want to look at the pennies per ton, which I think is the answer. Along with some protection for smaller operators in rural Oregon, we have 400 of those. But again, the big industry isn't going to Burns. There's no need to.
Okay, Senator Nelson, you're next.
On the major policy issue, you're talking about contract work. Could you give me an example of contract work and why is it a policy issue?
Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson and committee, may I address that? We have contract work that we do in both programs, and primarily our contract work is in Program 1, which is our geologic survey and services. What we would consider contract work would be an IGA or intergovernmental agreement with
for example, DLCD, Department of Land and Conservation Development, to assist them with some of their coastal zone management programs that they're working on. We would provide them with geologic mapping or maybe a hazard product, inundation or evacuation mapping product, something like that. We have contracts with the U.S. Geological Survey, with the Corps of Engineers, with Department of Energy, with parks and recreation, I mean, between federal
government
funds.
In the government,
and with local governments, too. We try to work with them.
Contracts? Do you do any private contracting?
We don't step on the toes. We are very, very careful about it. We work mainly with governments or other agencies. We don't private contract. For MLRR, for Program 2, as Mr. Lynch was saying, we have a contract, a two-year contract, to work with Columbia County to manage their permitting and operation for their mining operations.
Thank you.
All right. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do for us. If you could have your staff work with LFO staff here, I'd like to know where you spent the $100,000. I'd like to know on exactly what you spent it on. Category by category, I want to know if you reclassed any positions at that time. And I also need to have you, what would you have done had you got the fee increase, if you spent the $100,000 hiring the person you intended to hire, what would you have done to backfill the $100,000 in employee expenses that you actually spent that money on? Where would you have gotten that money from? Well, what would have happened?
Chair Krupp and committee members, if we had hired the position, if we had at the beginning of it hired, speculating that we were going to have enough money to backfill the over expenditures that we had and the position, we would have had to let someone go. There would be no way to backfill that type of a gap.
Okay, so let's assume everything worked out the way you thought it would. The fee increase would have actually brought you the amount of money you thought it would have.
Yes, sir.
And you would have hired that person, that block of money spent on that person. You still have all these other expenses you say you were operating in the red for.
For Program 2.
Okay, for Program 2. So the $100,000 that you didn't, okay, you spent on something. Now, had you got all the money you wanted, all that money would have hired a person. You still would have had to have spent that other money on something, wouldn't you? How would you have done that? Would you have had to let somebody else go? Where would you have come up with the money?
Chair Krupp, that is exactly what we would have had to do. If we had hired someone and we didn't, and we were still having that shortfall, then we would have had to let someone go, or some staff go in the MLRR program, which is exactly why we did not hire someone as soon as we had the permission for the fee increase, until we were seeing how both production was going to go and how the biennium was going to proceed.
Chair?
Okay, yes.
Can I make a... Maybe I'm missing something here, but I do a lot of budgeting, and budgets are budgets, they're not real money. So you budget ahead for 2 years. Let's say your budget, I'll take a round figure, was $1 million. If the revenue to back that budget up is based on the amount coming out of these fees, and the fees are variable depending on what the production is. Let me finish.
Chair Quill.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. So after 2 years, you find out, gee, we only got $900,000 out of our usual fees. We're $100,000 short. But we had budgeted for $1 million plus an extra fee to buy a new person. We didn't get the new person, and the only thing kept us completely out of trouble was we got $900,000 out of our normal fee schedule, picked up another half of that, let's say, and we're still $50,000 short. And we're short because the basis for our real money didn't change. We had this bump, but that didn't cover the missing, and it certainly wouldn't have covered another employee.
Chair Krupp and committee members, Senator Bates, that's well said.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for that, Director McConnell. We're going to, for all of the benefit of all of you, we're going to carry this over until tomorrow. Thank you, Director McConnell. I'd like to move back to public hearing and call Anno Husing. I know, Anno, you've come here to testify today. I want to be sure to give you some time to do that. I know that you've made a good faith effort. Please join us at the podium. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ono Husing. I'm the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. It's a nonprofit working for cities, counties, ports, soil and water conservation districts, and the Coquille Indian Tribe on the Oregon coast. And I'm here to testify very enthusiastically for DGAMI's budget in general, but in particular their coastal field office. And that's really why I'm here today, is to explain as quickly as I can how important the coastal field office is to the Oregon coast. It was created by the legislature several sessions ago, and a number of coastal legislators were the prime advocates for making the coastal field office happen. And what that really gave the Oregon coast was finally some objective scientific information about what happens with coastal processes, our beaches and dunes, how they move around, the effects on private property. So we got out of a situation where we had a lot of amateurs making allegations about what was happening on the Oregon coast based on something that happened in North Carolina or something. And so we really have a much better understanding several years into it now about what happens on the Oregon coast. The other major thing that's been going on is that it's really only two people that are in the coastal field office, and they're housed right with OCZMA in our offices in Newport. So we have an outstanding working relationship. And one of the individuals, George Priest, has really developed an amazing expertise in tsunami issues. And the bottom line is that we're going to have a tsunami summit here on Thursday in the Capitol, but all of our tsunami preparedness information comes from DGAMI. It comes from the inundation mapping that George Priest works with Oregon Health Sciences University, and it's basically a lot of NOAA pass-through money. But I got to tell you, if you're in a meeting with emergency managers, first responders, and others on the Oregon coast, and George Priest is there, the unbridled affection and respect for him in terms of the kind of information that he provides those first responders is, and especially since the Indian Ocean tsunami, I defy you to find a more effective office and more effective personnel in all of state government. They are just great. They work long hours. They're providing critically important information. And I give you, again, my most affectionate and respectful please make sure that they've, keep doing what they're doing. We'll explore on Thursday a lot more what Oregon's doing on tsunami preparedness, but I know the hour is late, and I will just take any questions from you. God knows I could talk about any of these issues for a long time. Wayne Krieger knows that, so I'm going to conclude my testimony with that at this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for
Ono? Don't answer the question. 5-minute answer.
Okay. Ono, thank you very much, and we will see you around here on Thursday.
Absolutely.
Correct. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to carry over till tomorrow, so thank you all very much, and we are adjourned.